I think of this as annals of the age of money. In your case, it's four or five books, many yet to come, I'm sure. We think of you, Michael, as the great tailspinner in the second Gilded Age, part muckraker, but very much part Mark Twain, for finding those classic characters as good as the King and the Duke and Huckleberry Finn, except that they're real and they're on Wall Street. The good, the bad, the geeky, the banks, the traders, making billions of dollars, mostly in the dark. But what you do is what the great novelists do, and I look for now. You write the moral ecology of the whole story. The sky, the light, the shadows, the weather, the atmosphere, and it's more important almost than the plot. 5 years ago in The Big Short, after the meltdown of the subprime mortgage racket, that center of the story was a thick air of anger and doom because virtually autistic misfits had seen through the problem when the go-along greedy guys hadn't. Only the mentally strange or handicapped acted, and they didn't come out heroes for being right. So here you are, you've taken on another disease in the money system. Trading has become a war of robots, a black box that almost none of the players get to see inside. It's too fast, too algorithmic, too fragmented, too automated, too layered for human understanding. Before you take it apart, I want to know, what's the big metaphor about us, all of us, the country, the culture, the world that your son is going to inherit?
Well, starting with Flash Boys, starting with the most recent book, the thing that attracts me to the material repeatedly is, I think, this persistent attempt by the money culture to systematize unfairness, to distribute spoils in ways that are really offensive. And the Flash Boys protagonists were so interesting to me, not because they'd found that there was a kind of corruption in the stock market and that the system had gotten rigged, because at this point, you know, it's really not that much of a surprise when you find broken systems inside Wall Street. I mean, the financial system is a mess. It was that these people who had stumbled upon the problem and gone to the trouble of figuring it out and create a picture of the stock market had this moral impulse remaining inside them. They were outraged by what they found. And instead of using their knowledge, as many people in finance had, to make money the wrong way, they'd taken a big risk with their lives and set about trying to fix the problem. It was very hopeful to me that this impulse still existed in people who were inside the financial system. And it was an object of curiosity to me. Why? You know, what was it about them?
This is almost a good news book compared to The Big Short.
It's absolutely a good news book. I agree with that.
Brad Katsuyama, Japanese from Canada, is as foursquare, idealistic, straight-ahead guy as you can imagine.
He's Dudley Do-Right. And no, he's really that.
And it's a gift for finding the others.
He's a character who is only believable because he's Canadian. There's no longer that person, if he were American, could not be plausibly drawn or be true. But he has this sense, this deep sense that the world's supposed to be fair, which I think we've lost in this country. He's trying to impose this deep sense on the financial system, which is quixotic. But other people feel this way. The minute you say it, other people rise to the challenge.
I love this guy, maybe because he's Irish, Ronan Ryan, geek. They call him a boxes and lines guy, really an inside tech. As you say, doing a fair impression of a Dublin handyman, but he knows high-frequency trading.
And he knows it because it is technology. He's strung the fiber optics through New Jersey and helped high-frequency traders set up their own systems inside the stock exchanges. So he's a curious character because his whole life, we thought what he really wanted to do was be a Wall Street hotshot, but Wall Street wouldn't give him a job. So he became this grunt who was working with boxes and lines, working with technology. And it turned out that working with the boxes and lines was the best possible training you could have for what the financial system was going to become.
Because it was going to become about the technology.
Yes, it was going to become about the technology. It's kind of great in his life and in the story. Brad Katsuyama finally gives him a shot at being a Wall Street big shot in exchange for teaching Brad about how the boxes and the lines work. And after about a year, Ronan says, oh my God, this whole world floats on bullshit. I mean, I can't believe this is what I wanted to be. Nobody knows anything. And he's completely disillusioned with finance when he gets inside of it.
Someday you're going to tell us how you find these characters, but there's a whole class of them in high-frequency trading. and somebody says, they used to be called Vinny, now they're called Vladimir. They're free agents, mostly displaced people, sort of antisocial, although they do know each other. And they seem to know they're rigging the game. They're the ones who are doing the wiring, in effect. They're known as scalpers. And it's a new generation, a nation of immigrants, a Wall Street of immigrants, Chinese, French, Russian, Indian, lots of them with advanced degrees in physics or math or aerospace. But the funny part is, and this is where the autistic thread comes back, somebody says they had no idea of the meaning of their own lives. The big Wall Street firms, you write, had become machines for turning analytically minded Russians into high-frequency traders. They're the bad guys. Well, no, I shouldn't say bad guys.
I agree. They should.
They're the reckless adventurers.
Or they're technologists with deep knowledge of a very narrow part of the financial system without any sense of what they do connects up to everything else. So they have no context for what they're doing. I mean, over and over in Brad Katsuyama's journey through this mess, he finds people who are really very intelligent and very gifted technologists who are shocked to learn what they've been building. It's like people working, I don't know, on building the first atom bomb, but they don't know what it's going to be used for. And it is a problem that's peculiar to technology people, that they become immersed in some very specialized part of the system, expert in that, paid well for that. They show up, do their job, do it well, but they don't ever ask the questions, what's this for? So that character is now all over the financial system. The markets, I mean the stock market, but increasingly all the markets, don't have people in the middle of them anymore. All trading is done algorithmically through black boxes, so by people coding the machines. Now, of course, on the top of all this, there are people who do understand how the system works, who do know what the instructions are that are being coded into the machines. I mean, there's a darker character. They're a more shaded character. But some of these technologists, there's an innocence about them. That character, if you go back to Liar's Poker, he didn't exist on Wall Street in 1985. Wall Street was becoming intellectualized then, more analytically minded people coming in and building math models of the markets. But the person who could get paid $1 million a year to write computer programs he didn't completely understand the purpose of, that person didn't exist.
How has Wall Street changed just in the last 5 years? The mood, the atmosphere in The Big Short was of absolute runaway greed in these new devices, up against the autistic vision of the people who saw through it.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's almost entirely different. You have high-frequency trading, and it's been limited to some degree. Your virtucrats with Brad have built an alternative, yet another exchange that may be straight for the next who knows how long. Is the financial system and the stock market still rigged in your terms?
Yes, absolutely. The rigging of the stock market is something that's happened since the financial crisis. That's the amazing thing. Most of the problems have been introduced partly by well-intentioned regulation since 2008. So what's changed on Wall Street in the last 5 years? You know what the biggest change is? Overwhelming self-pity. The people who are in the big banks, I mean, they may not have perpetrated the crisis, but they were present at the scene of the crime, feel unjustly hated and blamed by the rest of the society. They have a victim mentality, which is weird, but true. And they feel underpaid because their bonuses are being constrained in different ways. They feel under siege.
We had a great thing going, in other words, but no remorse, I take it.
I have never encountered it. It's the most amazing thing. And I think the reason is that we as a society fail to shame them properly. If you look at the last great financial crisis, you look at 1929, at the back end of that, you had these hearings in the Senate, the Pecora hearings, and people got put in jail. People were humiliated. People lost their careers. Wall Street left that period afraid and deeply shamed. And it really served as a kind of governor on the system. It's easier to regulate people who are afraid you could actually do bad things to them. And I think that having emerged basically unscathed allowed for a different emotion, and a kind of a different emotional response to the whole thing. They feel that anything that's done to them is unjust. They still have status, and they still have their sense of self-importance, and they still have the same friends.
Maybe that's the underlying theme for me, that the elites remain the elites, and the truth-tellers, the Brads, your garage band guys who stopped the housing bubble, are still kind of kooks or too virtuous to be true.
That's true. It's a problem that people who speak truth to power right now get quickly classified as oddball as opposed to important. I mean, it may be have always been thus, but there is a big problem in the culture of elites. I think what's happened, and it's partly because of the structure of the institutions, let's just keep it to Wall Street. The elites lack a sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. They lack a sense of responsibility to the larger society. They have a responsibility to their shareholders, to the bottom line, to achieving short-term results. But there isn't a sense of, for lack of a better phrase, noblesse oblige. It's been drained out of us. And I think it's been drained out of us because the people who are sitting on top of these institutions don't have any sense that they're partly lucky to be there, that there's a social fabric that made them possible. They think that they deserve exactly what they got. They are the end result of pure meritocracy.
You write in the book, the deep problem with the system was a kind of moral inertia. But I'm thinking also, 5 years ago, you were traveling with this book, of course, The Big Short, and you felt a palpable, almost insurrectionary anger at the Chamber of Commerce level. Small practitioners,
still exists. Dealers
in small towns, America.
Small banks are furious. They get saddled with the same regulations as the result of the financial crisis that they had nothing to do with. They are disadvantaged systematically in the marketplace by too big to fail banks, because those banks, because they're too big to fail, can raise money on preferential terms. They can't compete. I mean, essentially, market mechanisms have been stymied in the financial sector. There is a good banker. There's such a thing. If you kind of go talk to community bankers, they're as angry at the big banks as anybody in the country.
And ready to do what about it?
Well, this is where it gets interesting. The financial sector is not this monolith. The big banks are one part of it. The big brokerage houses, one part of it. But they're independent financial advisors all over the country. They're community bankers. They are less successful in coordinating their political influence. They just don't do it very well. Much less successful than the big banks. And I think it's partly because it's like herding cats. There is a signaling problem. They haven't done much about it.
Your guy, Rich Gates, who becomes one of the good guys in the new exchange, was a broker in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
Money manager.
He smelled something rotten, and he
started to run tests on the bank's dark pools, their private stock exchanges, and was able to get himself picked off by high-frequency traders, traded at old market prices to his great disadvantage, and then went with his findings to the Wall Street Journal, who kind of buried. I mean, he couldn't believe how little attention they gave it. And I think that, you know, if you talk to the great whistleblowers, you've talked to Brad Katsuyama, who's like painted a very persuasive and I think totally accurate picture of a rigged stock market, and ask them about the financial media, they'll say, all right, maybe they aren't bought and paid for, but they behave as if they are. You know, CNBC and Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal, the kind of people, the places that might be doing the really hard-hitting investigative stuff and explaining to the country what's happened, they're not doing it. And you could present them with all kinds of evidence and they say we're interested, and then nothing happens with it. I mean, who pays for the financial media? Who puts ads on CNBC? Our money just has a bit too much influence here.
Yeah. Political question. Has our presidential change agent, Barack Hussein Obama, missed his chance to change things fundamentally, even in the way we talk about him? And you've played basketball with him since you and I talked about it.
So I would say no, that it's not over. It's getting late. I would say they made a decision, and I think the decision was that the cost of radically restructuring the financial sector, which they could have done. I mean, they walked in the middle of a crisis. He could have done whatever he wanted to Goldman Sachs, and nobody would have said anything. The cost of that was it might jeopardize his desire to reform the healthcare system, that it might cost him political capital, and that the bigger problem was avoiding a Great Depression. And anything you did to weaken the banks was, in the short term, going to cause economic pain for people who just didn't deserve it. So I think that's a judgment. I don't know they were wrong. In my heart, I think they should have broken the banks up, because what happened was, by allowing them to get even bigger, they allowed them to gain even bigger political influence. So they queered everything that happened after it. And I think also the financial sector cannot be underestimated as a metaphor. It is the metaphor for what we think is just in the distribution of rewards. The financial sector led this whole CEOs get paid a gazillion dollars and everybody else gets very little. That starts on Wall Street. It could have had a huge cultural effect, I think, to say the first thing we need to do is fix this place because it bleeds into every other aspect of our lives.
I was surprised. I listened to the conversation you and I had 5 years ago around all this, and you spoke pretty sharply about the president. You spoke of Mr. Obama as a presidential version of regulatory capture. You said he's at the mercy of people who don't have his best interests at heart, but seem to know what they're talking about.
So my views...
Sounds like Larry Summers or...
Or Tim Geithner. I still believe that. He shaped his advisory team and then they shaped him. You know, I don't think Larry Summers and Tim Geithner are evil. They're just not radicals. They don't see the financial sector as much of a problem as I do. It doesn't bother them as much that people who aren't adding value to the society are being paid $20 million a year to do kind of nefarious things. It bothers them a little.
Why don't they?
And it bothers them a little.
Aren't you right?
I think I'm right. I think I look, if I was in a room with I would say, I mean, you read Geithner's book. Geithner actually is fundamentally bothered a bit by what happens on Wall Street. He's not a great admirer of financial types, but he's cautious, a little scared, creature of the system, emotionally, mentally captured by it all, is the way it feels to me, and unwilling to be ostracized by it. So that's not to say he isn't brave in different ways. I find him a very charming character in a lot of ways. This is a guy who was terrified of getting up to give a public speech agreeing to become the Secretary of the Treasury. I mean, it really was incredible. It was like if he was in this room before he became Secretary of the Treasury and you were asking him questions, he'd probably be sweating. And to accept that job was heroic in some ways. But he wasn't a character who was going to totally disrupt the system. And I felt at the time and feel now the system badly needs to be disrupted. One of the reasons I was attracted to Flash Boys as a story is I think maybe this is another way to do it, that maybe the market will disrupt this because it actually isn't sustainable in the marketplace. I can understand what they did. This is sort of like one of those decisions where if you made me president, said, Michael, you want to break up the banks and risk chaos in the stock market and so on and so forth, it might give me pause too. But if you told me how it was going to end, where we are right now, I would have much less compunction about creating chaos. I'd say, you know, we may have to suffer a little bit to get rid of this cancer that's in the middle of the society. These institutions that are exempt from market forces, that have a sense of kind of entitlement that's unbelievable, that have incentives that are so screwed up that they can get rich, bringing us to our knees. It needs to be fixed. It's too important.
And not called up on the carpet. We've never had a real open examination with all the witnesses present of what happened in 07, 08. I mean, we've got to demand that. And thank God you do a lot of it.
Well, I shouldn't have to, right? I'm a storyteller. I'm attracted to narrative and characters, and it just so happens that the financial crisis has yielded a couple of great narratives. But I'm not really an investigative journalist. When The Big Short came out, I was shocked when senators basically called and said, now I understand. Because I felt like, you're relying on me for your understanding? You should know already. The literary opportunity should not have been available. The literary opportunity for Flash Boys should not have been available. The Wall Street Journal should have been all over this story.
You know, we asked people on the street, what's to do about money? And some wise guy with an accent said, you know, go back to barter. Let's just get rid of it.
Money's useful as a means of exchange, as a store of value. Money is useful. Money is not the problem here. Problem is the structure of the system we have to handle the money. It is true that in the places in the economy where large sums of money need to change hands, there is a tendency for a lot of either destructive or completely useless activity to go on. People collect toll booths around it so that they can take a little slice. Because when you have large sums of money moving from point A to point B, you can take a little slice off of it and nobody really notices it. But when you add up those pennies, it's billions of dollars a year. It would be useful if our financiers were a lot lazier and less bright. You know, I think it would be a really good sign if the bottom half of the class of Princeton instead of the top half ended up on Wall Street. It would be very helpful.
No, they go into journalism.
That's true. It would be really useful if bankers were known chiefly for their solid family values and their desire to be home with their kids at 5 o'clock. The financial sector has been the site of a lot of really destructive entrepreneurial behavior. Great ingenuity, great energy, but the actual consequences for everybody is horrible.
We're in a funny period journalistically, I keep feeling, where you can actually talk about the warts, worse than warts, on capitalism. I wonder, is this the best system in sight in our lifetimes? Is it endangered by all the shenanigans you keep writing about?
I think it is, but there's not a system to replace it. So it's not ideologically, it doesn't feel ideologically endangered right now. It feels more like it's self-destructive, because there's nothing to keep it in check. I felt this way when I was watching the response to the financial crisis. If the financial crisis had happened in a world that had never tasted socialism or communism, we would have had a radical political upheaval. But the problem is there's nowhere for that upheaval to go. So they just fizzle out. Everybody kind of understands that these alternative systems have their own problems. So it's not as if there's an ideology to replace it right now. It's not beyond the human imagination to dream one up, but it doesn't exist.
A guy that fascinates me, Tony Judt, went to his grave prematurely saying there was an alternative, and we had it in Europe and the States in the 70s. We didn't call it social democracy, but in Europe they did. Capitalist economy with all kinds of social guarantees in transportation, housing, education. He grew up in London in the 60s and 70s. Free education made him one of the great minds of our time. And he says we're letting that go without a fight, and it's a scandal. Those were his last words.
Well, there was a fight, right? And capitalism won. Mrs. Thatcher and Reagan fought those battles. It isn't that there wasn't a fight. And in defense of the other side, which if you lived in London in 1981, 82, 83, as I did, there were an awful lot of problems with the old system. I mean, there was a horrible inefficiency there. It was dreary. And so the truth is more complicated. I think that capitalism has overshot, and there does need to be some clawing back. And I think we're seeing it a bit. Obamacare is that, right? The battle's still being fought. Problem is, the argument against putative free market ideology, and I say putative because, you know, what's going on Wall Street has nothing to do with free markets. These are government-sponsored institutions. They are not subjected to market forces. If they were subjected to raw market forces, they'd all be gone. So the problem is it's a rigged capitalism. Capitalism's name is being used to do things that aren't capitalist. That's part of the problem. And part of the problem is there's a streak, at least in our society, that I think is totally idiotic, that believes that markets solve everything. And markets fail every which way. So the intelligent approach is non-ideological. It's asking, where do markets work, and let's use them there. And where do they fail, and let's fix where they fail. And let's do it with a sense of decency and moderation and understanding that there are people who are weak and people who are strong. But that's messy and not ideological. It's sort of boringly sensible.
I think Tony Judt would sign on for most of what you just outlined, although he'd also spur us by telling us to believe our own intuitions of imminent catastrophe in the system we have.
I agree with that. The system we have is very dangerous. So I'd be with him on that.
Somewhere up there, he's happy to know that you agree. Michael Lewis, always an enormously one-of-a-kind pleasure to read your books, first of all, and to chat you up.
Well, thanks for letting me mouth off.